You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hey everyone, welcome to My Epic Defender Childhood. This week we're watching a kind of, I would say cult classic, but it has such widespread appeal. It kind of got a second wind, you know, about a year and change ago, when unfortunately David Bowie passed away. But I hadn't seen this, and for a lot of people it's very important developmentally, as, well, I guess panelist Charlie will mention, and I will mention on it, but you have a very sexy David Bowie and a teenage girl who wants to become a woman and all those good things. If you're listening to this, the day it comes out, I will be performing with Cineprov. We will be doing kind of Hollywood, Christmas shorts, doing Christmas classics, so to speak, including Santa Claus is Coming to Town and The Year Without Santa Claus, two Rankin and Bass classics. So I'll be performing with one of the two shorts, so please come out and enjoy us, and thanks for making 2018 an excellent year for Myopia and an excellent year for Cineprov. Thanks, guys.
Hey, this is Mike. A few months back, I was given the assignment of creating a new promo for the Air Station One podcast. I figured I had a ton of time, but I kind of got distracted. Go figure. And we realized we had somehow missed our deadline. So here I am late at night trying to figure out something creative to get you to listen to our show. I guess I could just use my announcer voice. Listen to the Earth Station One podcast. For almost 9 years, we've been bringing your inner geek out to play. We're a founding member of the ESO Network, and you can find us up on most media players like iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or wherever fine podcasts are found. I think that might work.
Welcome to My Epic Adventure Childhood. This week we start yet another Muppet movie without Thomas involved, so he can go screw right off. He'll show up for the last one. Yeah. But we did I don't know, would you say cult classic?
I would say so.
Cult classic, because it didn't do very well at first.
Yeah. So we have a cult classic here, Labyrinth, the erotic awakening of S. I'm Nick Hoffman, host of Myopia Defend Your Childhood, and award-winning comedian on Cineprov, and we have on panel
noted novelist Matthew W. Quinn, and by noted, I mean I have one.
He has a note that says he's a novelist that he's looking at right now.
Hello, this is 1980s David Bowie from the hit film Labyrinth.
Hello, David.
Bowie's in space.
Bowie's in spice. What you doing out there, man?
Anymore we'll be sued.
He's going to turn into an owl in the middle of the podcast and fly around the room.
So
probably.
Actually, that's a good place to start. This cold open is bullshit. Why would you start a movie where you have practical effects the entire time with the Muppets and you start with a bad CGI effect?
Oh, yeah. It goes on for 3 minutes.
And shows back up at the end to remind us it was only a movie, guys. Don't you worry. It was just a movie.
Yeah, that's something I didn't like is, you know, 3 minutes straight of a bad 80s CGI owl flying around.
Are we talking about the credit sequence here? Because I usually don't count the credit sequence unless it's something amazing.
Or Spawn.
Ooh, let's not go there.
Or, I mean, those early X-Men Marvel movies where you're like flying through eroding DNA or something.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I don't know when they decided that credits needed to be a thing or not be a thing, but this one decided it was not only going to do a thing, but it was going to be a revolutionary thing.
I kind of miss credits being a thing. I mean, these days, it's all just saved till the end because there has to be the post-credit scene, which no. And I don't know. I kind of missed it.
I saw Overlord with a friend of mine today. Granted, today is about a month from when this podcast comes out, and we stuck around to see if there was a post-credit scene. There was not.
No, of course there was not.
First of all, you shouldn't have them. You don't need them. I mean, the Marvel Cinematic Universe is like, I like them because it forces some poor schmuck to sit in the seat and see what the sound designer's name is.
And the best boy. Mustn't forget the best boy. He's the best boy.
It took me many, many, many years to realize there was a post-credit scene to L.A. Confidential.
Was it a musical number?
No.
Was it a tie into La La Land?
No.
What was it? I don't remember.
It was a, you know that TV show that Kevin Spacey's character was like a consultant for?
Sure, House of Cards.
Yeah, House of Cards. Also, probably a Woody Allen movie here or there. But anyway, Anyway, that TV show did like a memorial to him at the end of an episode, and that was the post-credit scene.
That is bullshit.
That's what it was.
Oh, you know what would have been better? If they tied in another film noir, like you see the Black Dahlia murder happen?
Ooh.
Like there's just a woman that they call Dahlia and they shove her out of a car? Like...
Too late, I think, for the setting, but yeah, I get the
who
point.
Who cares? I mean, by this point, like, you might as well give Danny DeVito a musical number. Like,
hello!
Your Danny DeVito needs a skosh of work. He's not Oscar the Grouch. All right, so let's talk about David Bowie. There's some ladies we know that are going to be very mad if we don't talk about it. So after the CGI owl, I know my second comment is George Lucas is an advisor on this.
Let's talk about the pedigree for this movie in the 80s, which is so weird about how it failed at the box office. This is a movie produced by George Lucas, directed by Jim Henson, written by a member of Monty Python.
And Jim Henson.
And Jim Henson, and starring David Bowie.
Which is awesome.
In the 80s, when he was huge.
This was 84. This is right after Ziggy Stardust. This is a huge deal. And he writes half the songs for this.
And it got negative reviews, too. I really like this movie. It's had some flaws we're probably going to get to later, but it's a, I'll use that word you like to use, Nick, charming.
It is
children's charming. Fantasy. It is. That teaches good moral lessons without being preachy and annoying.
Well, it's basically the 80s version of Wizard of Oz. If you watch the first scene especially, not the first scene where Jennifer Connelly's just in a park somewhere reciting faux Shakespeare.
LARPing by herself.
Yeah. Oh, she's such a sad goth girl in that one moment. So she's dressed in a damsel kind of version of a wedding dress with a wreath in her hair, reciting Shakespeare to herself, and I don't know, some Crystal Method is playing or something.
Well, the big thing is in the opening scene, which might cross over with the credits, is they show everything that's going to happen in the movie. Like, David Bowie shows up in a photograph as they're panning across her room.
Yep.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of subtext in this movie.
Subtext, that's a good way to put it.
And
subtext, I think there's a theory going around that the Goblin King is really her mother's new boyfriend.
That's not a theory. That's confirmed in the opening scene when they pan across a scrapbook that has her mother with David Bowie.
Yeah, but I mean, who is he
exactly? So here's the problem, Matt. You look at TV tropes sometimes for conspiracy theories, so much so that you're missing that this is actually in the movie.
Well, it's you just see the scrapbook with her mother and some guy.
Right. It's not Jareth that's with her mother, but it's still David Bowie.
See, David Bowie gets credited twice here, so he's like working extra hard. I'm surprised you're baffled by this, Matt. This is so simple. This is not the interpretive part. This is, it was kind of, like you said, I say the storytelling is very Princess Bride-ish.
Yeah.
It moves at such a quick clip. But yeah, so Daniel, give us a quick plot synopsis.
Okay, so it's this teenage girl who is obsessed with like theater and her own fantasy land, who's asked to babysit her baby half-brother.
Toby.
Anyway, she wishes, like she's read in fairy tales, for goblins to take him away, and they actually do. And in order to get him back, she has to go to the goblin realm and solve the labyrinth, which is this huge maze that goes up to the goblin's castle where David Bowie, as the king of goblins, Jareth, resides.
Yeah, that's about it.
And he just sits around bored on his throne until he randomly has a musical number.
Yeah. I'd like to do cocaine instead, but they won't give it to me because I'm 1980s David Bowie, not 1970s David Bowie.
But, I mean, frankly, it's because by 1986, cocaine was already old-fashioned. That's what white people did. He's probably doing some sort of, like, MDMA or something.
Ooh,
like,
there you go.
I have a chemist working around the clock to come
that
up with the newest
cross bulge. That would explain the magic dance.
That explains the cross bulge, too. He's just grinding up against his own latex.
Now, according to the Tribune, that was a sock.
I'm sure they say a lot of things to make it so he's not, like, practically grinding on children. But this is like a sexual awakening film for a lot of the women I know.
No, exactly, which is kind of why it's weird there's not a woman on panel tonight. But, yeah, you're right. This was a very big sexual awakening movie.
Well, and it is very much about like a girl becoming a woman and then a strong sexual presence around her. Although, again, unlike, say, Princess Bride or that really weird cut of Wizard of Oz, she doesn't hook up with the straw man she's created.
Oh, that cut. That was a weird cut.
That was a weird cut. In fact, maybe it's the other way around. It was a good cut that they made. but let's kind of get into this.
You know, Pink Floyd still syncs up with that cut.
I'm sure it does. Roger Waters is a perv. Yeah.
There's no need for that.
Yeah, no. It's just another brick in his wall. It's a Coke reference at this point. So she does that incantation holding up Toby because he's fussing and won't go to sleep.
Right.
And that's when the...
Well, there's the whole thing where a teddy bear is missing from her room initially.
Yeah, and she just loses her mind. She's 16.
And? She's 16?
Yeah, Jennifer Connelly was 16, and the character is supposed to be that same age.
Really?
I was a better sharer at 3 and 4 than she is as a teenager. Matt. She is so annoying.
You don't understand teenage girls. You had a younger sister. If you went into her room and took something from it, you don't think she'd be pissed at you from all, like, the bowels of hell?
I hate that.
Well, that's what Jennifer Connelly was doing as a child actor.
I mean, to be fair, my high school girlfriend, when you visited her room, like, there were every pillow, every stuffed animal had a place to be.
Yeah.
Her conniption is understandable, especially now that her mom has found a new guy and it's David Bowie. Be sweatered to David Bowie.
Well, also she has a stepmom. Is that the person at the
who
beginning?
She hates?
Yeah. Yeah.
And calling her by her first name practically. I kind of love that.
Well, it's kind of like that bit in Big Mouth. You're gonna take a nice big bubble bath and you're going to call your mom Shannon.
Right. And that's what it is. Because, like, she's like, we're going out tonight. He goes, you go out every week. And they're like, your mom is trying to get her some. Like,
oh, yeah.
Or your dad's trying to get
your
him
dad's,
some.
Yeah.
he's got a new wife. He's fine.
Yeah. And her stepmom is like, you need to go out on dates.
Yeah.
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 Again,
yeah.
Sexual awakening movie.
It's a sexual awakening movie. She's developing late. Then she sees all of David Bowie and she's like, hey now.
In 9 hours and 34 minutes, you'll be mine.
That's a hell of a reading because that's exactly what it is. Because he's holding a baby. He goes, hello, baby. You'll be mine. Yes,
is it 34 minutes or 33 minutes?
I mean, technically one than the other, right?
We'll get emails if I got it wrong. I just want to acknowledge
that.
Direct
them to dsuds at Twitter. It's fine. When you give your opinions on David Bowie, which we should get to here in a second, I'll pay attention to you.
All I ask is that you love me, obey me, and pay attention to me, and I'll be your slave. I am doing such a bad David Bowie.
And it's getting worse the longer you talk, so I'm going to let you keep going at this.
No, I'm not.
Thank you for the kind offer, Daniel.
So let's talk about Dave.
Okay, well, he shows up initially because Jennifer Connelly recites the incantation accidentally, apparently, and there's a bunch of goblins in her closet. But after she does, he shows up in her room and won't let her take it back and steals her half-brother away.
Right.
Oh, and there's a great bit involved where there's like a juggler behind David Bowie messing with the crystal ball.
Yeah. And that was the effects coordinator. I was reading about this.
Yeah.
He did a good job. And David Bowie, he just put his arms under Bowie's and did the thing blind, effectively.
And I never really noticed. I only knew about that because it pops up when I'm watching on Amazon Instant Video. Trivia bits.
Yeah. So for those of you who follow us, you can get this on Vudu for $2. You should do it. It's awesome. At this point, she goes through this kind of portal thing where she meets Hoggle and discovers the labyrinth.
Well, the whole thing is that the only way she can get her brother back from becoming a goblin is to solve the labyrinth and rescue him from King Jareth.
Within 10 hours. 13 hours.
Right.
And then because he's a complete prick, he then speeds up the time.
Well, he does everything he can to speed up the time. He tries to send her off course. He tries to get her to go back to the start. He bribes
Hoggle to giving her a poisoned apple.
Yeah, to roofie her, essentially.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
And all of this kind of leads him down this path of being kind of reset over and over. The movie doesn't feel like it's spinning its wheels, but she's supposed to feel like she never gets anywhere,
mm-hmm.
right? Even though she is actually advancing.
I will say this. Have you ever been to the Center for Puppetry Arts?
I have.
They have the Dark Crystal exhibit now.
They do, and they also have the Doors.
The talkie doors.
Yeah, one's telling the truth, the other always tells lies.
Yeah, and they don't get their own riddle, which is funny.
Yeah, that was great.
So there
were so many Monty Python moments in this movie. There's the doors, there's that beggar woman who's like trying to bribe Jennifer Connelly with toys.
Oh, the junk lady. That part was creepy.
It's a Monty Python bit.
Well, and it's also a George Lucas event.
You know what she's trying to do to her, right? She's trying to turn her into another junk lady by piling her with all this stuff.
Well, she's also trying to distract her because she's trying to get the clock to run out. I mean, I'm not saying you're wrong, Matt. Don't pout. But
better not pout. You better not cry. Well, Saint Nicholas.
Yeah. So you can't go through every single one of these little things, but like she takes out some lipstick at one point and she's trying to mark the direction she came so she knows where she's going. And there are these little goblin guys underneath the tiles that keep flipping them over so she doesn't know where she's been. There's the talking doors that talk in riddles.
The oubliette,
which has a cool sequence on how she falls.
Oh, the helping hands. That was cool.
She goes through the trick doors and falls down into, well, she starts to fall and these hands kind of catch her. They're called the helping hands and they make faces as they talk out of hands. It's kind of shadow puppetry.
Yeah.
And they said, do you want to go up or do you want to go down? And she says down and ends up in the oubliette where we run back into Hoggle.
Now, Hoggle is a character who she meets very early on who's gassing fairies to kill them.
Who it turns out are bitey, nasty little creatures.
Yeah. Well, it's like the bit in Harry Potter where Ron's teaching Harry how to get rid of gnomes.
Well, I mean, and it's also this... She starts to tell him not to do that in a world that she doesn't understand and then immediately regrets it, which is fine.
Yeah, there's so many moral lessons in this movie, like appearances can be deceiving. Oh, you monster, you're gassing fairies. No, fairies are nasty, bitey little pests.
They were cute, though.
Appearances can be deceiving.
You're right. Hoggle's the whole, like, Muppet character. He's probably the biggest Muppet character in this movie, and...
except for the big dog thing. The big monsterman. I have a note.
Humongous? I think it's actually...
Oh, Ludo.
Ludo.
Oh, Ludo.
He reminds me a lot about the Masters from the Dark Crystal.
Smell bad! That's my Ludo right there.
And roaring and summoning rocks.
Rocks! Friends! He's basically Boris Karloff as the Frankenstein monster.
And he effectively uses his rocks to whoop up on an army of goblins, including a goblin mecha with a machine gun.
That's later in the movie. Right now, Hoggle is like a subject of Jareth, and Jareth's telling him to get rid of Jennifer Connelly.
Yeah, he's just... Hoggle is actually very well characterized. Like, he has low self-esteem, no friends. Jareth bullies him, and he knows he shouldn't screw with Jennifer Connelly, but he does, and he hates himself for it. For a little puppet creature, he's surprisingly got some emotional core there.
What's interesting is that he knows what's in the labyrinth, which implies that the labyrinth has existed for a long time.
Well, and on top of that, we have... I'm trying to advance this a little bit, but only because we're talking in circles, which is the point of the movie. But yeah, so... Hoggle turns out
describe
to be...
Describe the movie? Me? No, I'm just a worm.
Well, I mean, and they do a bunch of that kind of stuff, right? Like, you have all these weird optical effects, like she walks through walls. In fact, we were arguing at first if it was more ripped off by Harry Potter or what, because when she never remembers Hoggle's name, at one point she calls him Hogwart.
Yeah.
Hoggle!
And then they do the whole, nine and three quarters... thing where she's walking up to a wall at like the Harry Potter train station. And right. If you hit it at the right angle, you just go through the fake wall, which I thought was great. It's the right time period for her to plagiarize it too. It's 86, right?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
We're on to you, J.K. Rowling.
Oh yeah. You billionaire, you. But my favorite thing,
I shake my fist at you.
Give us lots of money and we won't pursue this any further.
She's fine. Don't worry. Don't you worry about J.K. Rowling. She's already bought and sold more people like you this week than you will in your entire life.
Excuse me, J.K. Rowling, I need about Tree-Fitty.
A Tree-Fitty. When she steps through that fake wall and ends up in the actual labyrinth, this is where the Monty Python bit that stood out to me, right? Because you were talking to you.
Yeah.
She runs into someone and goes, which way to the castle? And the woman goes, it's that way. And he goes, oh, it's a good thing she went that way. If she went the other way, she'd already be at the castle.
Oh,
yeah, if she went that way, she'd be up at the castle. I had the line. I wrote the line down.
Yeah, and she wouldn't have had all her friends along the way, though, so things could have gone rather wrong.
Well, they kind of, the whole point is they kind of sort of do go wrong.
That's the point. She's supposed to fail, and she does fail the whole time, right? She only gets to the end, and then the world collapses on her, which is kind of weird. This is a very trippy third act, if you haven't seen it.
Well, let's get to Magic Dance, because Magic Dance is about like 20 minutes into the movie, and it's probably the most famous scene in the movie.
Please.
It's a musical sequence with David Bowie singing to
Toby
about how he will possess this child.
Yeah, and there's about 5 or 6 David Bowie songs in this.
Well, I downloaded them all from Amazon Music. Plug there. Please give us money, Amazon.
Yeah, right.
I think there was 5, and one of them was a reprise, so...
Fair enough. So he does bust out. He actually sings,
yeah.
And it's utterly charming for him to be traipsing around with these trollish, like, troglodyte of Muppet characters.
I'll go ahead and give some trivia from the Tribune at this point.
Sure.
Sting was who Jim Henson wanted as Jareth.
Yeah, but they saw Dune and they said no. The producers were like,
well, so he's not going to prance around in a steel Speedo?
Oh, man.
Or without pants on at all. So they just stuffed half a wardrobe down his crotch and they said, go for it, buddy.
There you go.
Yeah, this is 2 years after Dune, so I think someone saw Dune and they're like, no, Sting can't be in it. No.
I will kill him. Seriously, his delivery needs work.
Yeah.
Who?
Sting.
Oh, Sting is the worst.
Yeah, I'm agreeing with you.
Yeah, no, Sting is the worst. And he only has, like, he's in the movie a lot, has no lines because he's awful. No, he is.
No, you're not wrong.
Brad Dourif's in that movie, too. Hero Brad Dourif.
So many good character actors are in that movie, but Dune has shit.
Dune, not only is it Fincher's worst by far.
You mean Lynch's?
Lynch's worst, yeah. David Fincher's Dune. Oh my God.
Oh my God, that would have been a thing.
Couldn't have been worse.
No, it couldn't have been.
No, couldn't have been worse. There would have been a lot more heads and things. It would have been much more gory. Anyway, so Dune.
So we're here talking about Dune, directed by Jim Henson, written by a member of Monty Python, Terry Jones.
And the giant worms are Muppets. Yeah. Sounds kind of cool.
It's pretty much there, frankly. We did that. The American version is called Tremors.
There you go.
Anyway, so at this point... we have the dance number you talked about. I mean, she goes through a labyrinth. There's not a lot to say about it. It's excellent. There's a bunch of little
logic riddles that she encounters. There's the bit with the talkie doors where one always tells the truth, the only other tells lies, and then
she ends up in the Oubliette.
And then after that, the Swamp of Eternal Bad Stench?
Swamp of Eternal Stench.
Okay, that was it, yeah.
And then Sir Didymus, who's like a 80s puppet rocket raccoon.
No. Oh, Sir Didymus is great.
A dog.
He looks like Crumb.
Speaking of a Wizard of Oz reference, it's her dog.
Yeah, it is her dog.
Yeah, it is her dog. But it looks like Salacious Crumb, the guy who sits and laughs on Jabba the Hutt's leg. That's who it's supposed to be, right? It's even George freaking Lucas 2 years before.
I figured it was a drunk Errol Flynn.
Yeah, it's like it's Salacious
Crumb. Wasn't raping anyone.
Salacious Crumb crossed with Leroy Jenkins.
That's good. What year did Return of the Jedi come out?
83.
Oh, okay.
We can argue about this. I'll look it up. But
Daniel
83.
Yeah, Daniel, it is a film hardcore guy.
So the year after Dune, he turned down Return of the Jedi to do Dune, which came out the next year. And then this came out 2 years later.
Oh, George, I could just imagine David Lynch doing Labyrinth.
David Lynch's Labyrinth. George Lucas should have directed it, but he was like, no.
No, he was the producer.
Steven. I think I should direct this movie. Darn it.
Well, hello there. Hello there, George. You asked me to direct your movie about a teenager's sexual awakening. Well, I'd rather do a TV show about that, George. I'd rather do a TV show. Do you understand what I'm saying here, George?
Well, Steven, the thing is that Luke is too old already, and, you know, Leia's a little too old, too, so what if it were another little girl?
Well, age is just a number there, George. Age is just a number. Sometimes age is a word. You know, age is a word. Do you know what I'm saying here, George?
You know, you didn't even go to film school, you prick. You should you should listen to my ideas.
I directed an Eraserhead. It took me 5 years to make Eraserhead. I would sometimes just direct on the weekends, and there was a little deformed fetus that I'd have to direct. Do you know what I'm saying here, George?
You know, he just gets like this sometimes. You know, you should just listen to me, and, you know, it'd be for the... Now, the thing
thing is, if you get Steven Spielberg involved, he'll calm his shit down because he just can't handle being yelled at by a better man.
Is it easy being green, Nick?
It's Jim Henson, man. Jim... Jim was the voice of Kermit. That's all I got. It's all I got, Matt. It's all I got. Anywho's, it's... So, I mean, what do you want to talk about? She just stumbles through the labyrinth for a bit. She ends up at the end.
Well, I want to talk about the bit with Sir Didymus when that whole bridge sequence, which was like a leftover sequence from Monty Python and Holy Grail. Yeah.
Please.
That whole bit where he's saying, nobody can cross this bridge without my permission. Well, do I have your permission? Yes. That's a little bit of great anti-humor there.
That's very Monty Python.
Yeah.
Well, it's also very Muppets. That's something I learned when I watched this. I even not knowing until about halfway through when I started doing my notes that Monty Python had been involved, you realize how close the Muppets are. I mean, to be fair...
Do you remember that bit on the Muppet Show when John Cleese hosted?
I do remember that. That's a great show.
Yeah.
I mean, but like, you know, Muppets... I mean, like Kermit's one like knife cut away from being a suicide most of the time in the later stuff, especially.
Yeah.
They're all Monty Python characters and right down to Miss Piggy being voiced by Frank Oz, right? Like, oh, yes, I'm like.
Can it, frog?
Yelp. Oh, Piggy, I'm so sorry. Don't hurt me, please.
Oh, well, why would I ever hurt you? You were expecting moi to hurt you?
I mean,
well, if you want moi to hurt you, I
can't do the voice well.
You're fine.
I will get on my leather cat suit.
Safe word tonight is frog. It's banana. Banana is the safe word, frog.
Nope. I got nothing to follow that one up.
The whole thing is they go through the labyrinth. They go through like the big challenges, which are very Princess Bride. Like you said, there's the swamp of eternal stench. There's the bit with the doors. There's the helping hands.
There's that wall of it's like a hallway filled with talking faces that I just wrote. Looked out of the ledges of the hidden temple.
It's talking faces that talk trash.
What was up with that bit where it's a musical number where all those puppets are taking their heads off?
The fiery. That is so weird.
That is from a different movie. And it also, I mean, literally it looks like they had to go back and refilm it because that's the one part that doesn't hold up at all, man.
Bad blue screen.
Well, that's the most terrible thing because I saw the Kevin Clash documentary.
Yeah.
Where he talks about that scene and how just desperate Jim Henson was to get it right.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. It's the Being Elmo.
Yeah.
And it's... I can't imagine because it doesn't look like anything. It's a bad backdrop. It's bad effects. For a movie where everything else lives and breathes, this feels like a bad SNL sketch.
A bunch of Caribbean Muppet birds that pull their heads off harass Jennifer Connelly and try and pull her head off.
It's a great technical scene from puppetry standpoint, if that makes sense. I mean... Getting that scene done would have been phenomenally difficult because I know it was all done real instead of just with CGI cheats, but you're right. It has no bearing to the plot.
And it doesn't feel like anything. Whatever. I mean, you're right. It does seem like it took weeks and the Clash documentary talks about it. It's just, it's a shame.
And then after she gets most of the way through the labyrinth, there's a bit where Hoggle feeds her the poison apple. And then there's that David Bowie song, As the World Falls Down, where she hallucinates herself in a ball or something.
Which is right out of a David Bowie music video. Actually, it looks like it's out of a Tom Petty music video.
No,
right?
I would say David Bowie.
And she's in a princess dress getting pursued by David Bowie.
Yeah. Well, and I was thinking of the Tom Petty one where they do Alice in Wonderland.
Don't come around here no more.
That was good. But he wants
her to come around there. That's the whole point.
Aww.
Gross.
Yes. How old was she again? 16? Okay.
It's the age of consent in Germany. Germany's like the Alabama of Europe. People with keen comedy knowledge knows where I ripped that off from. So, but from there, like we do, it looks like, you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of a scene out of Archer where he's convinced there's a vampire or something. Mm. It's also that scene from Dracula Dead Loving It, right? Where they're trying to prove that he's a vampire. So they have a giant mirror put regardless.
Oh, I remember that. It's been forever since I've seen Dracula Dead and Loving It.
And for good reason. It's garbage, except for the one scene where they're staking Maria through the heart.
I saw it on Comedy Central.
That never ends.
Yeah.
Back in like 2002.
We will watch it for that one scene. You will laugh your ass off. It's the funniest ever, regardless.
I saw it as a kid, and I saw it at Nick's old apartment like 10 years ago, and we're watching it like, this sucks.
I remember that bit with Renfield being in prison, and like 10 seconds later, they let him out, and he's like going, you're being released for good behavior. But I've only been here but a moment. And in that moment, your behavior was very good.
After giving him an enema, apparently.
Yeah. Well, and then he's out, and he goes, I must find the master. Master, master. Oh, wait, they'll be listening. Mister, mister. And he goes, he was trying to find his master. He goes, I thought he said mister. Ah, but that was only a trick for the people minor.
How come David Bowie never played Dracula?
Oh, my God. That'd be a great role next year for him.
He should have been in the Francis Ford Coppola version. Gary Oldman was great, but David Bowie should have been it.
In the Coppola-verse?
Yeah.
He could have been there next to
Keanu Reeves.
Oh, no. Wait, Keanu was
saying Winona Ryder.
Who was Keanu Reeves?
Jonathan Harker.
That should have been Gary Oldman's role.
Yeah.
I thought Harker was supposed to be young.
I don't care. Anything would have been better than Keanu Reeves.
But a desiccated David Bowie as Dracula is much better than Gary Oldman. Gary Oldman should have been Van Helsing then.
Yeah. Hmm.
That's a thought.
It is. I literally just had that thought and said it out loud.
So after, and it's funny what prompted this, as the world falls down, Jennifer Connelly wakes up in her bedroom and there's a puppet that comes in trying to give her junk to...
This seems right out of Star Wars to me. Like a junk dealer is just, it's how we open the droids on Star Wars, for Christ's sake.
Well, it's not even a junk dealer, it's just somebody who's like going, Charlie Bear, you love Charlie Bear, here's Charlie Bear.
Here's the Teddy Ruxpin.
And it's piling all the stuff on her in such a way that Jennifer Connelly's starting to resemble her.
Yeah, basically.
And that scene creeped me out.
Matt doesn't believe in owning things.
I think that's the
one... Most millennials apparently would rather have experiences than stuff.
Oh, have you been playing Millennial Monopoly?
Capitalism is the worst.
This fucking government. Okay.
Matt's along for the ride as he's yawning at you. So yeah, so she starts piling up with crap. At this point, Jennifer Connelly, whose name is something. I'm sure
Sarah.
Sarah.
I didn't even bother. I just figured, okay, young Jennifer Connelly.
Yeah, I'm good. I'm on board.
This is like her third movie, so.
And yeah. She's good in it.
Yeah, she is a very good actress in terms of how she did Sarah's arc from being a whiny brat to being a mature person. She handles it very well. I think Jennifer Connelly's acting was one of the best parts of this movie, even though apparently reviews from the time said it wasn't very good.
Well, again, because this was like her third movie, so there was no comparison.
Well, and I think her first real movie she was in was Once Upon a Time in America, which is a masterpiece.
Oh, damn right it was.
We need to do The Rocketeer.
Yeah.
Yeah, eventually.
I mean, and she's good in Rocketeer.
And then her second movie was Phenomena, where she talks to bugs.
She sure does.
Yeah, and then she psychically communicate with bugs to find a killer.
And then she's in a movie called 7 Minutes in Heaven, which better be a horror movie.
I think it's...
Oh, no. It's soft 80s friends shit.
Oh, I thought it might be one of those kind of C-grade Christian films where someone who dies in a car accident is briefly dead and is brought back to life.
Oh, no. That was the one, that kid that was faking it. Something of Heaven.
I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, I turned out to be lying about the whole thing. It'll bug me.
All right, so eventually she figures out that this is all just a plot from Jareth, and she makes it to the gates of Goblin City.
Yep.
And at there is where she, Hoggle, and Ludo, and Sir Didymus all fight that mech. Which, let's go over this. How do they re-meet again?
Hoggle climbs up on top of the wall, and he drops into the cockpit and throws the pilot out.
Right, but how did they get back together after
when she finally realizes what the junk lady is trying to do, either they're busting down the ceiling to get to her or her realization.
That's right. Yeah.
Her realization causes the whole scam the junk lady's trying to pull to break down, and they end up pulling her out of a hole.
That's right.
And they end up back in the right on the verge of the edge of the Goblin Kingdom. They go inside and they start a thing. Also, I will point out We did Ghostbusters 2 5 years ago now, almost 4.5 years ago.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. And at one point, Egon says, I let her check out my epididymis. And we looked around at each other because I knew what it was. And that's the tube that attaches the testicles. And so when they kept saying Sir Didymus, my wife looks over and she's like, isn't that the testicle thing again? And I'm like, no, that's something else. It's gross. Anyway,
I don't know. And how not to be seen Monty Python referenced another bit of the penis. So why not?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's some phallic objects here. Most of which are attached to David Bowie.
Let's talk about the phallic objects in this movie.
David Bowie exists. So yes, that's all does. You need to know. He's romping around in a leotard in the most glorious Tiffany wig you've ever seen. But anyway, at this point, we have another musical number. We're in the castle. He tries to misdirect them like it's out of a Saw movie or out of Jason or Halloween 6. They're in the basement and they're running around the hallway.
Ooh. Yeah, the Saw movie. You have to cut off your foot, Jennifer Connelly, and shoot Hoggle.
I mean, someone should shoot Hoggle. Fucker, like, sells her out 3 times. I don't know why she's so nice to him, but...
This is the bit with the M.C. Escher maze, right?
That is cool shooting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's why you need... We can talk about Jim Henson directing kind of here. What do you think of him as a director?
I kind of don't think of him as a director because he was always such a technician to me. So having a director on a Muppet movie or a Muppet anything just feels like a formality.
This is written by Terry Gilliam, right?
Terry Jones.
Terry Jones. He should have come in and directed it and then had Jim Henson do the technical shit. 100%. Because, like, he clearly doesn't know how to direct Jennifer Connelly. That's why I think people thought she was doing bad as an actress. She clearly had no direction. She doesn't know where to look half the time. I think she's doing a fine job.
I disagree that anybody would criticize her. She did fine. She was an overdramatic theater kid.
Yeah, I don't think it's entirely appropriate here.
I disagree.
She has a really good arc because she is such a hellacious brat in the first part of the movie. And then once Jareth shows up and she realizes what she's done, she's like, okay, time to man up.
That's a funny way to put it. There are those scenes like where she solves a bit of the labyrinth and goes, I'm getting way smarter. But I mean, to me, that's more emotionally honest than like a lot of other children's films that are just talking down to kids because that's how teenagers think.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's badly written or assembled. I just don't feel like it flows very smoothly. But where his technical direction shows is in this labyrinth scene at the end where it's like the M.C. Escher painting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because at one point the baby's climbing horizontally and then it turns the camera 90 degrees and is actually climbing up the stairs sideways. Very Alice in Wonderland-y to catch the baby.
I expected some Bionic Woman effect or $6 Million Man effect when she jumps like...
Yeah, there you go. And then overall at the end, she gets the baby back. Or whatever. That's a big or whatever.
Love me, fear me, and I will be your slave.
And that's the actual
that's
line.
That's the line. Controlled save, nailed it. And yeah.
She goes back home. Her parents arrive back home. Toby's back in his crib and everything's good.
And she gives them a teddy bear, which is a nice character growth marker.
Right.
Right. I mean, my other notes here don't even make sense.
Well, I mean, the actual ending is when she's looking in the mirror and all of her friends from the labyrinth are like looking back at her.
And they have a rave.
They have a rave.
Basically. It's a magic dance.
And then there's the owl outside, which is probably Jareth. Take a hint, dude.
Well, no, Jareth is real, right? Because this is all in her mind.
Yeah.
Jareth is just a dude. He's boinking her mom or whatever. I called it the Eyes Wide Shut party, by the way.
Whoa.
Hey, man, when you have that much of a crotch that you're thrusting through a crowd and everyone's wearing masks and everyone's also on drugs.
That's right, sir. That is the password. But what's the password to the house?
Oh, you're talking about the masquerade ball, not the scene at the end where they're all having a dance party in her room.
No, that I called the Rolling Stones at Altamont. But
Got stabbed?
So there's a Hell's Angel involved somehow?
Well, that was the final raid on the house. You cowered before I was frightening.
Take off your clothes.
Yeah, well. So we're kind of just dancing around this movie.
Magically dancing around this movie?
What are your thoughts, Daniel?
I enjoyed this movie. It's kind of a shame that there aren't any women here, because I feel like this is a more important film, at least from what I've heard from my female friends, to them.
Yeah.
Overall, I enjoyed this movie. I mean, I don't think it was necessarily a something that was meant for me as a child. It's kind of a shame that none of our female friends are on the panel tonight, because I think it was a lot more meaningful to them. But even watching it now, it holds up pretty well. It's got a great soundtrack. It's very well directed. I mean, yes, there are some clumsy writing bits, and yes, there are some clumsy acting bits, but it's just so charming overall, and I couldn't escape from that charm. So, yeah, it was a fun time.
Thank you, Matt.
Okay, I'll concur that this is a charming movie, and it's very good for a children's movie for a kid who maybe has a new sibling they resent, or part of, you know, a blended family that's not working out too well. Jennifer Connelly does an amazing job as Sarah, and this is, again, her third movie role, so that's pretty impressive. I didn't really like David Bowie's presence that much.
Ooh.
Because, I mean, like musicals integrate musical numbers much better. This one, they just seems like want to have excuse to have him sing. But still, I would give it an 8.5 out of 10. I thought it was pretty good.
Excuse me. I'm going to challenge you. An excuse to have David Bowie sing.
They only hired him to sing.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's the point. Well, whatever. So my final thought is, Matt, you're wrong. He's best part of this movie.
Middle finger rises.
I mean, because I just think that Jennifer Connelly, she's fine, but they give her a lot to do. Not a problem. She's acting against nothing for the most part. I don't think he's and I think Jim Henson is not particularly good at directing people to direct, to act. Overall, I think this movie is fun. It moves really quickly at times. The pacing has some problems, but it's perfectly enjoyable for a kid's movie. It reminds me of something like Princess Bride, where, again, it moves very quickly at times, and just assumes you're along for the ride, that you don't really care.
This should have been a bigger hit than it was back in the day.
Yeah, it lost money.
Life's Not Fair, which is a whole movie talks about. I wonder what your point of comparison is.
Yeah, I wonder what your point of comparison is. So tune in next week. We're going to finish our Muppet month. At this point, you've already gotten at least one bonus feature, but we're going to add one extra bonus because I forgot one in October. So we're going to get a Disremembered on top of the Muppet thing that already came out. And we're going to wrap up the month with the only way we could wrap up a Muppet Christmas month, with a Muppet Christmas Carol. And I guess I'll trigger this now, because I want this active Twitter community to follow up. We've been getting about 200 or so responses for every Twitter poll I put up. Keep following us at My Opinion Podcast. But January is going to be filled with our disappointing sequels. Starting off with a musical tribute, which you guys will get after a hint about next week. But stay tuned next week and every future week as we put another piece of your past on trial. And have a merry, merry Christmas.
Myopia Defend Your Childhood is produced by Dude Letter Podcasting and a member of the ESO Network. It is hosted by Nick Hoffman, edited by Daniel Suttis and Ann Byrne. It is produced by Daniel Suttis, Matthew Quinn, and Ann Byrne. Thomas Herman is our consultant. Nick Hoffman is our executive producer. The theme song is Surf Shimmy by Kevin MacLeod. Find it at incomtech.com. It is licensed under the Creative Commons license. Thanks.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping through Amazon.com or the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.